Can the West still deal with counter-insurgency? Recent events in Afghanistan and elsewhere suggest not. The historian John Ferris, former professor of history at the University of Calgary, and the authorised historian of the UK's government communications headquarters, usually known as GCHQ, joins us to cast his cold eye over the last two centuries of counter-insurgencies. He looks where Western powers have got things wrong and how they might learn the lessons of the past to make counter-insurgency operations successful once again. Well, John, you've made the bold assertion that it may be that liberal states can't do counterinsurgency. And the reason you give that is evidence of the conflict in Afghanistan between 2001 and 2022. Could you explain the deep history of that? I mean, going back to the West's relationship with Afghanistan over two centuries.
Well, my main point about Western liberal states finding counterinsurgency extremely difficult to deal with stems from the fact that if you're going to conduct effective counterinsurgency against a serious enemy, you have to be willing to kill lots of people.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to kill lots of innocent people. If you're not willing to do that, by definition, you're handing over a great deal of power in a reciprocal competition to your foe. And liberal states have demonstrated a real difficulty in dealing with counterinsurgency unless your own life is threatened. So the Israelis are actually able to deal with a real problem across both Gaza and the West Bank, in large part because the Israeli population is convinced that if they're not hard, harsh and tough-minded, they'll be destroyed. So that's my general point. If you look back historically, actually, it's possible to say that both the British in particular, but also the French, had a fair amount of success in what you could call counterinsurgency, although I'd call it irregular warfare, mm-hmm. in the 19th and early 20th centuries. But notably, after 1945, when they became more liberal and their actions are under media scrutiny, they found it much more difficult to conduct counterinsurgency campaigns. And the record has not been particularly good since. Now, in the case of Afghanistan, you know, there's a tendency for us to sort of fall victim to slogans like Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires. In fact, Afghanistan has never really caused great problems to any major empire. The difficulty from the perspective of any great power that's around Afghanistan is that it's got a very weak state. It unfortunately does have influence over Pashtuns living outside of Afghanistan. It's an inconvenient neighbor, and it's weak enough that most of Afghanistan's neighbors at one point or another in the past few centuries have tried to control it. Now, if the only issue is, can you walk into Kandahar or walk into Kabul? The answer is yes, of course. But the dilemma is that once you're there, what you find is that the state is weak, it's broke. The only way that any state operating out of Kabul can actually influence Afghanistan is if it's given lots of external resources, which it can use to build military support or buy political support. And that's expensive. And historically, what happened to the Mughals and what happened to the British in the first and second, third Anglo-Afghan War, essentially was that at a certain point, their governments are saying, why are we here? Why are we spending this money? What are we gaining? And the Russians confront much the same experience in the 1980s. The dilemma is that, in fact, foreign governments overestimate the value of controlling Afghanistan. And you can do it if you have enough money to bribe lots and lots of people. Afghanis are perfectly willing to be bribed, especially if it means they don't actually have to do anything as a result of being bribed. But as soon as you're not giving them anything, things blow up. The other problem is that historically, when Western governments have become involved in Afghanistan, we have found it very easy to believe, as I would say falsely, that Afghanis are barbarous, they're uncivilized, They don't do things the right way. We are the exemplars of the best of human evolution, whether you're a Russian or a Brit or an American. And therefore, we must have means to raise you out of your condition and make you better. And the end result is that we alienate lots of Afghanis, but we also overestimate our own ability to actually stay there. So our assumption in our own cultural and technological superiority leads Western governments and also the ex-Soviets toward overestimating the ease with which you can radically transform Afghanistan. So the Russians go into Afghanistan somewhat reluctantly.
This is in
1978. Somewhat reluctantly, but they also go in believing that this is a winnable war and that indeed it won't be that difficult to make Afghanistan into at least a socialist regime. When the British go into Afghanistan the first time, they're convinced that they can actually improve the quality of Afghan government. In fact, what they do is make it much worse than it had been before. And certainly when we went into Afghanistan after 2001, we found it dangerously easy to believe, especially because the Taliban collapse as rapidly as they do,
and are all but wiped out.
Entirely wiped out. In fact, there seems to be evidence that the Taliban actually made gingerly movements toward the Americans, saying, if you're willing to cut a deal with us, we're willing to end the war. But the Americans weren't interested in talking about it. So I well remember, in it was early 2002 in my university in Canada, our foreign ministry was sending teams of people across Canada talking to academics in every university. And what they were saying essentially was, we're going to reform the family life of every place in Afghanistan. We're going to transform the position of women. And I remember saying to them, do you really think that this is going to please the overwhelming majority of males in Afghanistan, let alone a substantial portion of women in Afghanistan? So the ease with which we can imagine that our higher level of technological skill is going to allow us to transform the population of Afghanistan is a form of hubris. It's a form of ethnocentrism, and it hasn't worked. Now, I'm not going to go out of my way to praise Afghanis in an unusual fashion, but I'd say that their way of life is their way of life. And in a lot of ways, we really don't have any particular ability to criticize them. Now, if you're forced into war with Afghanistan, as we were in 9/11, the other cases I've mentioned were clear cases in which the Russians or the British decide to invade Afghanistan for their own reasons. Mm-hmm. I think we had no option but to go into Afghanistan. If we hadn't done so, we would be saying to the world, guess what? You can slaughter 4,000 of our civilians and get away with it, and we won't do anything.
Which is rather similar to the dilemma Israel faces.
Oh, it's exactly the same thing. Although I personally am one of those who believe that the sins on both sides of that equation are very, very mixed. And in fact, my own belief is that the population of Gaza essentially consists of people who were ethnically cleansed by Israel in 1948, in some cases unavoidably. Nonetheless, it's also my belief that you have to let the Israelis annihilate the political leadership of Hamas before this war can end, even though that means that probably tens of thousands of civilians in Gaza are going to die. It's a terrible thing to have to say, but I believe that's true. Mm-hmm. You cannot allow people to kill your civilians and get away with it. But once we were there, we had no idea what we were going to do. And for the first 5 years that Western forces were based in Afghanistan, you couldn't get political traction within NATO or within the United States to actually do anything meaningful in terms of policy in Afghanistan. Bizarrely enough, the Western military figure who had the biggest influence in Kabul was the leader of the relatively small Canadian force that was based in Afghanistan in the early 2000s, a guy named Rick Hillier, who was a very good soldier. But the Americans made no consistent effort to figure out what their policy should be. And during that period of time, basically, the Taliban came back anyway. And then when we decided that we were going to have this window of 18 months of active counterinsurgency, which would transform Afghanistan.
And this was Obama's.
This was Obama's business. And as soon as you say 18 months and we're gone, you've just said to the Taliban, wait 18 months and then we're gone.
Do you think it's a fair summary of the kind of overriding strategy that people told themselves progress has been made, but challenges remain at various points when the challenges were underrated and the progress was overrated?
You get a lot of people who criticize the American military for having had a positive media spin. Well, all I would say is that I read everything I could find about Afghanistan. I talked to hundreds of American, British, Canadian military personnel during that sort of 10-year period. I read what the very small number of real Afghan experts in the Western world and also people like Ahmed Rashid had to say. And what was clear is that they were writing a penetrating, powerful criticism of what was not working right in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So all of the material was there. And if people weren't willing to read it or listen to it, I don't blame the American military or the Canadian military, for that matter.
But you do blame Obama.
I blame Obama only in the sense that the strategy he was pursuing was one which you really had to be, I think, extremely naive to believe.
Okay.
Basically, on the one hand, what he said is that General Petraeus' surge in Iraq was a failure, but I'm going to copy it and apply it, and in 18 months I will do something which no one has succeeded in doing ever historically. I'll make Afghanistan a peaceful place.
Could you take us through some of the kind of on-the-ground tactics that were implicit with the counterinsurgency?
Well, once the counterinsurgency happens, the first thing you're actually doing is sending NATO forces out to the provinces, which had not been done. Mm. And so what had happened in 2007 is, for example, 1,000 Canadian soldiers were sent to Helmand and Kandahar, which later on is a place where the Americans based 40,000 Marines. And essentially, if you put 1,000 soldiers in a dangerous place, there's not a lot that they can do. The performance of the Canadian military was fine, but you're not going to win that way. And the issue of basing our forces in far-flung areas, which was the initial idea behind the counterinsurgency effort, essentially meant that we sent isolated forces in the middle of nowhere. Mm. Now, later on, what occurred became a double-edged sword, and that was the fact that the Americans, followed by the British and Australians, pursued a very aggressive policy of using the best intelligence they could find to hit individual Taliban targets. Now, a lot of those strikes were actually pretty accurate and precise. The dilemma was, however, that in many cases, our intelligence was essentially controlled by one faction in an Afghan community who wanted to use us to kill their enemies, and we very foolishly did it. The other is that, unfortunately, it's very clear now that there was a corrupting effect of this constant use of special forces on special forces. It is now clear that the British, American, and Australian special forces, who were doing immense work, actually were, at a certain stage, allowing elements within their ranks to go out and kill Afghan people for no reason other than they wanted to kill them. That corrupted every special force. The Canadians didn't make the same mistake because in the early 90s, there'd been a massive Canadian scandal in Somalia, which led to a big reform in the military. Yeah. And so the end result was our special forces in Afghanistan were much less fast to act than, say, the Americans were, which meant we didn't do nearly as much good as the Americans did, but we managed to avoid most of the bad that happened.
And the scandal.
Now, the final thing is that although I would say that the use of special forces and UAVs was actually surprisingly precise, Tens of thousands of Afghans, innocent Afghan civilians, were killed. And in many cases, killed for absolutely no reason whatsoever. Now, we were very lucky that that did not cause Afghan civilians to start killing us. In effect, they were very angry that it was happening, but they were willing to accept a blood price. So culturally, Afghanis are willing to, if a member of their family is murdered, they're willing, if they wish, to be bought off. You pay them a blood price. And that's, in effect, what we were able to do. But nonetheless, I mean, I have to say that clearly, I personally, by about 2014, and I, at this stage, knew a fair amount about how things were happening. I thought to myself, there is no solution here. And that, you know, American military people I was talking to, even before that, had really been openly willing to say privately, there's nothing working here. So I had no problem with the idea of President Trump or President Biden deciding that they're going to rapidly tone down the American or NATO presence. On the other hand, it was also clear to me, and I think to any rationale observer, that if the Americans completely pulled out, Afghanistan was not going to survive against the Taliban for long. Mm-hmm. There was a famous Rand Corporation study of the collapse of South Vietnam, which I have a copy of. And the amazing thing is, if you looked at their account, which was based on interviews with, you know, South Vietnamese politicians and generals who left, it was astonishingly similar to what Afghani politicians and military officers had to say as their regime suddenly imploded. And in the end, I look at all of this and I think, well, I'd be much more critical than I am now if the Americans had started all of this without provocation. I am still critical about the way the Americans, but also NATO, handled a situation because we never actually sat down and clarified a strategy that we thought could work, except for the one which Barack Obama supported. And I have to say, I know of no credible military analyst who believed that an 18-month window was enough to allow any kind of counterinsurgency campaign to work.
And what, if anything, could have been a measure of success?
Well, you know, I've spoken to people who are middle-level, senior American military personnel, and my own conclusion is that the only way I could have been a success is if Osama bin Laden had been killed in the initial few months, and the Americans could say, we've won.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished, we're going home. And in fact, in hindsight, if we had hammered the Taliban and then pulled back and said, never, ever think of doing this again, we could have achieved our objective, which I have always maintained, and I've maintained in hundreds of media interviews in Canada for about a decade. Our only interest in Afghanistan is to keep Afghanistan from being a problem to us. We have nothing to gain from being there. Maybe we should be nice. But it is really pointless to imagine that there is any national interest for Canada that's linked to any kind of specific regime or social reform in Afghanistan. I spent a lot of time looking at how the British dealt with Afghanistan. And one of the important lessons is that by the early 1880s, the British learned how to handle Afghanistan, and they never make a mistake with Afghanistan again. Essentially, the point is you try to maintain in power a government that owes you something. You provide it with enough support to allow it to stand on its own two feet. You do not try to conquer Afghanistan. On the other hand, the problem that left for the British is, what do you do with all the Pashtuns who are on your side of the border that you've imposed with Afghanistan? So the bizarre way the British run the Northwest frontier occurs precisely because the British have a rational strategy toward not being involved in Afghanistan. But as it turns out, it was much easier to live with the Northwest frontier than it is to try to conquer Afghanistan.
Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.